This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Okay, let's talk transit. The T, to be exact. After another string of bad, and if we're being honest, slightly weird headlines of late, the MBTA's recent mishaps run the gamut from the annoyance of slowdowns to the terror of a falling ceiling tile. Here to talk about it in Studio 2, Andrea Perdomo Hernandez, WBUR's transportation reporter, and former Massachusetts Assistant Secretary of Transportation Chris Dempsey. Andrea, welcome.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Chris, welcome back.
Great to be back. Thank you.
We also have on the line Taylor Dolvin, transportation reporter for the Boston Globe, and Jared Johnson, executive director of Transit Matters. Taylor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And hey there to you too, Jared.
Thanks for having me as well.
All right, so everybody bear with me for a second, because I want to set this up a little bit differently. We have done a lot on the problems, right? And it is, and there's new stuff to talk about today, but Boston has four conventional rapid transit lines, plus the Silver Line. They run underneath the city's core dense neighborhoods through tunnels. It's not like any cities could really be digging tunnels like that now. Most of the subway lines have multiple branches. 12 commuter rail branches serve people from as far west as Worcester to as far east as Plymouth. So, Chris Dempsey, starting with you, could we be best in class? Do we have the infrastructure if we could get it up to where it needs to be and lay out a vision?
That has to be the goal, because the future of Massachusetts depends on public transportation working. What we do best as a state relative to any other state in the country is we bring the smartest people in the world together in very small spaces, like downtown Boston, Kendall Square, the Longwood Medical Area, even downtown Worcester. And those places only work, the density of those places only work when you have well-functioning public transportation. That's why you're seeing people like Jim Rooney, the head of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, repeatedly putting the MBTA at the top of his agenda as he advances the economic interests of the state. We have to have a standard of being best in class, best in the world. We are not going to get there overnight. It's going to take years or decades, but we need to be moving in that direction.
And Jared Johnson, you know, Chris saying very small spaces, we are, I think anybody who comes and does the, you know, the Freedom Trail the first time is amazed at how walkable in a day that portion of Boston is. Now, that there's more Boston than that, but we are a relatively very small space. It does seem that we could move beyond, why can't we get this together, all the way to, this is a walkable, transportable, non-traffic, greater Boston, and not small g, greater, right, Boston, right, than we are now, Jared.
Absolutely. And you know, something I've been saying is that the Harvard Square, that ceiling tile falling is really sort of a metaphor, because, you know, the excuse that sometimes people will say is, oh, well, the system is so old, it was built in 1890. That ceiling panel wasn't. That ceiling panel was built in the 70s and 80s when we did have a transportation system that was known around the country, if not around the world, as one of the best transportation systems. You know, we extended the Red Line, rebuilt the Orange Line, you know, renovated, you know, dozens of Green Line stations. And so, you know, I think we do have to have that sense of optimism, because we have, you know, rescued the T from dire straits before, and we're going to have to do it again. We don't have a choice. That's the only, as Chris said, that's the only way that Greater Boston and the whole of Massachusetts thrives is by having a world-class transportation system.
All right, so Taylor Dolvin, there's the potential, right? If we establish that is the potential and the necessity, that gives a whole different context, or a whole additional context, to the frustrations and the challenges that we're experiencing now, not only because they affect the everyday lives of people, but because we could be not just better, but in a whole different class. So now let's backtrack to where we are. And let me start by just having you explain the ceiling panel thing that Jared Johnson just referenced.
Yeah, earlier this month, a ceiling panel almost fell on a commuter who was leaving a Red Line station. And I think Jared's comparison as a metaphor for the whole system is spot on. This is something that's definitely not supposed to happen, shouldn't have happened. And we're very lucky that this rider was not seriously injured. And I think it just goes to show just how deteriorated some of the infrastructure, not just the tracks themselves, which we spend a lot of time worrying about, but the stations too, just how deteriorated that infrastructure is and how much of an effort it's going to take to get things back to a state of good repair.
So, Andrea Perdomo Hernandez, you have been talking to some riders. You brought us some sound from a rider named Kevin Sonko of South Boston. He was at a protest on Sunday. We'll talk about the protest later, but his sound gives us some other things to talk about, too.
I've lived here for 3 years now, and it's gotten worse every year since every year that I've been here. And, you know, I understand that marshaling efforts for public works is hard, but, you know, the state also has, like, a multi-billion-dollar surplus, and it just feels like for a transit system that's a global hub for just, you know, education, finance, that we could just do better.
So, you know, I hear him saying not only this affects my life, but this affects how I view my city. Are you hearing that? Are we moving beyond or in addition to, man, now I'm going to be 20 minutes late to work, and to, come on, who does this say we are?
Absolutely. I've spoken to a lot of riders from Friday on, Sunday at a protest, and there is just this sense of just frustration and just why? You know, we just heard from Kevin, who's lived here for 3 years, and he said that it's been getting progressively worse. And I think people are kind of like going from like, okay, my train's a couple minutes late, to like, this is a chronic problem and we cannot tolerate it anymore. So I think there's definitely that sentiment, at least among the people that I spoke with.
Okay, so Jared, in a minute, we're going to dive into the newest round of slow zones. And let's put a hash mark in time that is last summer, right around the time we find out we're going to shut down the Orange Line for a month and portions of other lines, where we know we had all of these challenges around timing and slow and you couldn't get on a train, et cetera. Is that rider, Kevin Sonko's perception that it had been getting increasingly worse in the time before that, actually true?
Yes. Yes. I mean, undeniably, the condition on the Red Line has worsened dramatically in the last year, even before the general manager said to plan an extra 20 or so minutes because of this latest episode. The total time on the Red Line had increased by about 40 minutes. From an end-to-end journey from Quincy to Alewife. So undeniably, he is correct on that. And I think we've also seen, in addition to sort of the hard problems, the problems that are related to the infrastructure, I think we've also just seen just service quality just go down. I mean, you've got the issues with the control center and cutting frequencies on the rapid transit lines. And then I think because operators are so stretched, you know, it's, you know, they're not even able to keep to the headway. They're not even able to keep to the already reduced headways. And so you're seeing degradation of service, you know, you're seeing the longer travel times because of the slow zones, and people are having to wait longer at stations. So that is an undeniable, absolutely quantifiable fact.
We're talking to transportation advocates and reporters today about this moment where we are with the MBTA, starting with what it has the potential to be and how that puts in context the moment that we're in. And Chris Dempsey, to hear Jared Johnson say, yep, even before last summer, when it kind of feels like the T-world caught on fire, pun intended, mm-hmm. right? We were looking at 40-minute slowdown in the Red Line over time. That must mean decades of maintenance neglect, mustn't it? I mean, that cannot happen over 5 or 6 years, or am I wrong?
No, that's right. It's decades of underinvestment and decades, and especially the last decade, I think, of not understanding just how fundamental some of these problems are and that we need structural changes to fix them. So the ceiling tile falling in Harvard Square is a good example. That's a symptom of the problem. What happened with that ceiling tile is there was a leak in the tunnel above the ceiling tile that dripped down onto the tile, saturated the tile, it became too heavy, and it fell out. So what we see there is that there was no one at the station who was just doing a regular check to make sure that the tiles were in good shape. And maybe even worse, no one doing maybe a six-month or annual check of the station to pull those tiles aside and look for leaks above them. That's the kind of preventative maintenance work that needs to be happening, that best-in-class transit agencies would do, that we're not doing here because of decades of neglect and mismanagement. And it results in these really concerning and troubling incidents, like someone almost needing to go to the hospital. If that had been a foot different from where it fell, they would have been in the hospital and maybe worse.
Yeah. So, Andrea, the video on that, right? There's a young woman. She's walking to the escalators, right? And at just before she takes the next step, boom, right down in front of her. And she even described, you know, inhaling by an accident, you know, dirt in her mouth, and 25-pound thing could have gone right down on her head.
Yeah, it was inches from her. It's incredible that not only do you have to worry about getting to where you're going to get to on time, but also you have to be constantly aware because of your surroundings, because of things like this.
Okay, so that gets me to a lightning round that I want to do with the four of you. And then we're going to take a pause, but I want to do this lightning round first. Question number one, I'm just going to go around. Is the tea actually safe, Jared Johnson?
Yes, I take it every day, yes.
Taylor Dolvin?
Oh, yes. I mean, the chances are you are going to be safe riding the MBTA, yes.
Chris Dempsey?
I've been riding the T my entire life. This is the first time in my life where I've questioned my basic safety getting on a T. I still ride it every day. I rode it here to the studio, but it's concerning that the incidents are so frequent and so severe.
And Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez?
I would say yes. The incidents are really disturbing when they happen. They shouldn't happen at all, but they don't happen so much that I would question my own safety while I'm riding.
Okay, one more lightning round, reverse order. Andrea, can one take the T somewhere and be on time?
I would, depending. You would have to bake in tardiness. You know, you would have to bake in padding if you want to get there on time.
Chris?
Plan ahead and bring your Kindle.
Taylor?
It is becoming increasingly hard to make that happen. I would say it really depends on which line you're on.
And Jared?
Yeah, it depends on the line. It would be tough to take it if you had an appointment you could not miss.
All right.
And that's the truth.
Nope, finish that thought. We got time. Go for it.
Oh, no, I was just saying, that's the truth. I would think twice about taking it if it was something I absolutely could not miss.
All right, so now we have the stakes. We are diving in, digging in, heading into the tunnels on what is the latest in the moment we're in with the MBTA. We have four guests with us, reporters Taylor Dolvin of the Boston Globe and Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez here at WBUR, plus transit advocates and experienced writers Chris Dempsey and Jared Johnson, all still with us. We've covered what the stakes are. We've covered what the potential could be. We've even covered the falling ceiling tile in Harvard Square. Taylor Dolvin, now what I want to do is start breaking down for people what we mean when we say these slow zones that were happening, but then they weren't happening, but some of them are still happening, that began happening last Thursday night. So start with last Thursday night.
Yeah. So to give you an idea, Thursday morning, about 7.5% of the tracks of the entire T subway system were slow zones, or areas where trains have to travel at reduced speeds because of problems with the tracks, basically places that need to be repaired. Come Thursday night, the T says that there's going to be a 25-mile-per-hour speed limit on the entire subway system. So 100% of the tracks are now a slow zone. And that was because so far the T has said that its oversight agency, the Department of Public Utilities, asked the T for some documentation about the safety of its tracks, and the T wasn't able to find it, and then wasn't able to find it for a lot of spaces along the system. And so out of an abundance of caution, put this 25-mile-an-hour speed restriction in place system-wide. And to give you an idea, the top speed on the subway system is 40 miles an hour. So this is a lot more travel time for people. Now, 6 days later, the T has been able to lift speeds in some areas on the red, orange, and blue lines. But 100% of the Green Line and the Mattapan Trolley Line remain at this 25-mile-an-hour speed.
And Chris Dempsey, you took the Green Line over here today. How'd that go?
A nice slow ride, and I'm glad I did get here on time, but I was cutting a little bit close. Was also on the Green Line on Saturday with my wife. We were meeting some friends for dinner. We thought we had left with enough time to get a drink before dinner, and in the end, we were 10 minutes late for dinner because of slow zones and actually shuttle buses as well, with the Green Line Tunnel closed in portions. So that's a pretty typical experience for an MBTA rider these days. You get where you're trying to go, but you leave early and you arrive late.
So Jared Johnson, MBTA Interim General Manager Jeffrey Gonneville, was on GBH yesterday talking about how this all went down and explained that he personally authorized the slowdowns Thursday night. Here he is.
Ultimately, it was my decision to implement those system-wide speed restrictions, and that was based upon the information in the briefings that I was given late in the day on Thursday. Immediately after that decision was made, the teams went and began implementing this slow order across the entire system.
Much has been made, and there's been a lot of dismay, Jared, about, okay, this press release comes down at like 10 o'clock Thursday night. Some members of the MBTA staff even said publicly that they did not have all the information they needed till sometime on Friday. Sometimes bad stuff just happens. It happens when you don't expect it, and you have to do what you have to do. Is this a moment, or should it not have been necessary to make this last-minute announcement on a Thursday night that affected people who were trying to get to work Friday morning?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was better to know that Thursday night than to have done it Friday morning. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in an ideal scenario, you know, if you had hindsight, would you go back and do it differently? Perhaps, but I do applaud the general manager for acting quickly on that information and for being transparent about the process. I'm glad that we finally have a DPU that is performing their job. And I think, you know, when we look back at some of the work that Taylor has done, and we see the level of interference from the from the previous gubernatorial administration, and we see the ways that stymied the T acting quickly or being transparent about things, I think this is a breath of fresh air. So I think on balance, I think you made the right decision, and I think on balance, you know, the issue of whether you do the press release first and then do the work, that to me is not as important as finally having an agency that is being more transparent with its riders and finally having a T that is able to do its business without, without the corner office micromanaging every aspect of it.
Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez, Jared's reference there, Department of Public Utilities, responsible for safety oversight of the T and heavily criticized in the federal report and the federal findings last summer of 2022, about a failure to do that. And it was their inspections on the red line that led to the documentation issues that Taylor mentioned. We'll come back to that in a minute. That led to these slow zones. So all of that, you know, Jared says it's encouraging. They're getting the work done, the DPU. But on Friday, what were riders saying?
Oh, on Friday, they were just telling me that they had noticed that the service was way slower and they had no idea why, you know, coming home on Thursday night. And then some of the riders that I spoke to learned from me what was going on, and that it was like a system-wide thing.
When were you out there on Friday?
On Friday, immediately after the press conference. So I wouldn't say
morning.
Yeah, late morning, early afternoon. And they were just upset about what I heard consistently was that they would love to see signage at their stops. They don't want to get to their train station, going to work or whatever, and then see on the monitors that their train is 20 minutes or more late. They would love to kind of have that communication the minute that they come in or even before.
So I want to go now, Chris Dempsey, into this kind of gnarly documents thing, which is a little bit confusing, but really, really important, sort of for the same reasons that of my question of, wait a minute, 40 minutes slower on the red line has to be years of decay, right? So we're going to go back to MBTA Interim General Manager Jeffrey Gonneville. I just want to make sure I've got the source on this one. It's press conference Friday, talking about this reporting,
When a defect is identified, they will implement and take matters, and they'll begin addressing those issues in the field and then documenting those issues and then providing that information back. What they were looking for was that supporting documentation. In this particular instance and in these particular cases, not just here but also globally through the system, there is some documentation inconsistencies and some areas where the documentation does not exist.
That sound from 25 News. So here's what's going on here. He's saying, We have a process, and part of it is paperwork. And the paperwork is literally missing. And we can't run trains in part because we don't have paperwork.
So let me make 2 points on this, Tishiana. So the first is, I think you actually summarized it pretty well. The DPU, the Department of Public Utilities, is the regulator of the MBTA. There's been much coverage and great conversation on this show and others about the DPU really not living up to its job and the standards we should have for it in recent years. They're now stepping up. But I think you can see the challenge that the T has in now reporting to this regulator in a new way and not having the correct systems in place to be able to justify the actions that it's taking and document those. That's not an excuse that it's new because they should be doing that anyway, but I think that's the tension that you're seeing there. The second point I want to make here, and I used the word mismanagement earlier in this conversation, I think Jeff Gonneville is a very strong interim general manager. He's someone that is committed to making the system better. You can hear in his voice in that press conference the tension that he's under, the frustration that he has that he's not able to do a better job. He's making the most of a very difficult situation, but it's representative of years and years and years of the T not having the right systems and processes in place. Funding is a big part of it too, but it's also about the organizational culture. We've had a series of different general managers over the last five or eight years, more than I can count, frankly, at this point. We need a new general manager to come in to be a stabilizer, not a savior, but a stabilizer of the system to put some of these processes in place so we never have a situation again where we have to slow down trains because, frankly, we just couldn't find the paperwork that showed the system was safe.
Would you take that job right now?
It's the hardest job in state government. So I think you have to be someone who is experienced and ready to take on the biggest challenges to do that job.
And I guess I need to ask you, Chris Dempsey, are you in the hunt for that job right now?
I'm not. The governor has made very clear that she's going to do an international search for that job. And I think we need to give her the time to complete that search. But whoever takes that role next needs to have the support of everyone at the MBTA, across state government, and folks like Jared and I in the advocacy world, because we want a system that works better. And none of us are here to throw shots or throw bombs. We want a system that works better. Great reporters like Andrea and Taylor and others will hold that general manager accountable. But all of us in the civic community want an MBTA that's successful, and we need great leadership to do that.
So as Chris just noted, we're here on Radio Boston diving into the latest on the T with Chris and Jared Johnson, both transit advocates, and reporters Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez of WBUR and Taylor Dolevin of the Boston Globe. So Jared, I do want to move into the solution space, right? And let's stay with this question of the hires, because there's a safety hire and a general manager hire. Massachusetts General Maura Healey, general. That's when you get governor and AG blended together. I'm just going to call her the general from now on. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey wanted a 60-day turnaround. We are past that date now. John Keller from Keller at Large had said somebody from Ottawa was in the running, but that the Ottawa person said they weren't in the running. Is this a moment where the person who could do this job wants this kind of challenge? Are you optimistic that somebody who's got the chops to do it is somebody who would want to come do it here?
Oof, that's a tough one. I think, you know, again, going back to the history that Petit has, I think, you know, being general manager of you know, the oldest subway system in America and the history and pride, I think is something that would be attractive. But I think that we have to start, I think that the team has to start making some changes now, even before they get a general manager, and the legislature and the administration need to show that level of support, right? Because I think that's part of what's making this job hard to attract talent for is that folks know that they are going into a very difficult job with a lot of challenges. And I think they need to know that they're going to have the support, and they need to know that they have an institution that is ready for change, right? That institution that knows that it's not in the best, not in the best state, and that you have, and that you have staff that are ready to change and ready to to rebuild this agency. And so I think that's why I've said that I'm not advocating that we wait for general manager to start making these changes, to start making progress on hiring, to start, you know, changing some of that organizational culture so that staff feel supported and are able to give, you know, the best service possible. So I think that's really what's on my mind is that the team and the state have to make some positive changes first. And I think that is going to be what's going to make the search easier, because it's exceedingly hard to try to bring someone into this situation and for them to not know whether or not they're going to have the support to be able to enact those changes.
A lot of nods from you, Chris Dempsey.
I think Jared is right that we can't wait. And this is a job where if you are an experienced transit operator elsewhere in the country or in the world, maybe you're in Ottawa, maybe you're in San Diego or Washington, D.C., you already have a challenging job, but do you really want to go to Boston to take on an even more challenging job with the risk and the turnover that we've seen in this role? And again, I'm sure that Governor Healey and Lieutenant Governor Driscoll are doing the best that they can to find the best talent around the state, around the world, to come in and do this job. But I don't envy that task of finding someone. It's a little bit like being the general manager of the Red Sox. It's a job that everyone cares about and thinks that they could do better than the person that has it. It's not an easy one. And again, it's why I applaud people like Jeff Gonneville, who's taken on that role. And while I've been critical of past general managers, I salute anyone that raises their hand to take on this job. It is such a vital institution and organization for the present day and future of Massachusetts. We need good, talented people in that role.
Taylor Dolvin, is there anything else that you've been hearing in your reporting about the search, the role, public concern around it? Is it what the public's focused on? What else do you know?
I think when I talk to riders, there's less concern about that vacant position. There are hundreds of vacant positions across the MBTA that are directly affecting the service that the T is able to provide. So, for example, the MBTA has cut bus frequency over the last year consistently and is missing more than 300 bus drivers that it needs to be able to increase frequency again. I think the general manager is obviously a very important role, but there are just hundreds of people needed to be able to get both subway and bus service back to where it was pre-pandemic, so that people can start to rely on the system like they used to.
So, Andrea, when you went to the protest on Sunday, and I noted that there was a protester there with a sign that said, "Sorry, I'm late to the protest, but I took the tea."
Yes.
All right. So everybody's got their sense of humor on this at the moment. But you talked to Kendra Beaver of Dorchester, who noticed a degradation in the reliability of the Red Line. Here is Kendra.
And it's just disappointing, because if the infrastructure was properly taken care of, it could be a really thriving transit system. Just want to see it get better, if not at the very least the same that it was when I first moved here, and it was much more reliable.
Do riders believe that Massachusetts will make the investments, do the work, and the infrastructure will get better?
I believe so. I think, and I think the sentiment of the people there was like they're going to do everything in their within their power to make that possible. So they're like, we'll come out as many times as we need to. We'll go to as many community meetings. We'll do what we can to get that reliable service that they want.
Chris, briefly, what's the nut, money-wise, to really get where we need to be baseline right now? What's the nut?
So the deferred maintenance or the backlog maintenance is in the multiple billions of dollars. That would be if you could drop money from the sky onto the MBTA today, what would the cost be of fixing all the stuff that's broken? You're talking $6, $7, $8, maybe $10 billion for that. Then you've got, just as important, the ongoing operating deficits, which means every year there's not enough money for the T to meet its budget. And the federal government most recently, because of the response to COVID, and the state government historically have stepped in to fill that gap. But we don't have any guarantee that either of those funding streams will continue in the future. And so you may just not have the resources to run the buses or run the trains or keep the lights on in the system. that's hundreds of millions of dollars a year, every single year, that's the type of gap that we have. So these are big structural issues. They're not solved by little cost-cutting initiatives here and there. We need to have a real tough conversation once this leadership is in place to say, what do they need in one-time and ongoing revenues to help fix the system?
So Jared Johnson, when I hear that, there is a piece of me that thinks, is this a math problem that just doesn't work? Have these numbers gotten to a point and the decline of the infrastructure gotten to a point where we have, do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, no, we've seen systems around the world come from, I would argue, sometimes even worse places than where the tea is now. And we're the wealthiest state in the country. I mean, we have an economy just in Greater Boston, the size of a small European nation. So we have the resources. We just have to marshal them. We have to marshal them, and we have to have long-term fixes. Like Chris said it perfectly. You know, we filled it around the edges. We have cut the tea to the bones in years past, and none of that has worked, and that's brought us to where we are today. And so it's time to invest in the system, and I think it is. It's exactly that. It's an investment. There have been reports from business organizations, from A Better City, about how the tea on their $2.5 to $3 billion budget, you know, produce an annual benefit of $11 billion, and that's in the time that the tea has not been at its full potential. And so, you know, I think the value that it adds to the Commonwealth is really incredible. And so we have to fix the operating deficit and really make the tea stable and whole. We have to fill that capital backlog. We're going to see the capital budget sliced by $800 million this upcoming summer, and then it's going to be cut down by two-thirds over the next few years. And so, you know, we just have to make it a priority. But we absolutely can do it. I don't think it's too far gone, and the tea is just too valuable to let it just, you know, crumble.
All right, rapid fire with our reporters to wrap. Taylor Dolvin, what are you watching for next?
I'm watching for a real vision from this administration about what the goals are. At a board meeting earlier this month, the head of the board of directors for the MBTA said that these lower ridership numbers we're seeing, far lower than the T expected, are the new normal. And people were really upset by that, partly because a lot of the reasons that people aren't taking the tea are because the service has degraded so much. So I think we have yet to see a really clear vision from this administration about what the ridership goals are, for example, or where we should be heading exactly. So I'm definitely on the lookout for that.
And Andrea Perdomo Hernandez, how about you? What are you watching for?
I would like to see where this investigation into the paperwork and the slow zones and what kind of led us here. That's what I'm interested in short term.
And optimistic that we'll get some answers?
I think so.
All right. Andrea Perdomo Hernandez of WBUR, Taylor Dolvin of the Boston Globe, Chris Dempsey, former Assistant Secretary of Transportation here in the Commonwealth, Jared Johnson, Executive Director of Transit Matters. Thanks. I really appreciate it. Given us a lot to think about. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There is more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. You're listening to Radio Boston. Family can be complicated. Okay, who am I kidding? Family is complicated. And for Boston author William Landay, family is all you need for a plot, motive, and a great murder mystery. Well, Bill is a local New York Times bestselling author and former assistant district attorney. You might remember his last book, set in Newton, Defending Jacob, which is now a television series on Apple TV Plus starring Chris Evans. His latest book is All That Is Mine I Carry With Me. It came out on March 7th, and it is another novel set in Greater Boston and weaves together elements of family and aging and wealth and, yes, murder. Bill, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you.
So you make me scared of my family member. What is it with you and family?
I think that crime novels are a prism through which we can look at other more interesting things, especially relationships, and especially relationships with the people closest to us. Those are the most universal experiences, and these sorts of stories allow us to speak about things that sometimes are hard to articulate and hard to see.
So I've read Defending Jacob. I read All That Is Mine. I carry with me to talk with you today. And one of the things that strikes me in both of them is that there is an intimacy to family that can be exploited for a kind of disturbing vulnerability in your stories that feels different to me as a reader.
I think that's right. I think that all people are a mystery to us. We can't really know other people. And so the idea that the people closest to us might have secrets, might have flaws, might have things that frighten us, is a scary thought. It makes us very alone in the world, and it makes the world a much more precarious place. In this book, a suburban mother goes missing, and the father, who's a criminal lawyer, is immediately suspect in the crime. And the thought that someone in our family might be capable of a crime like that, or might go missing, might be a victim of a crime like that, makes the world seem a very precarious place. And that is the area that that I find is dramatically very interesting. When you put people under that sort of stress and that sort of crisis, they tend to reveal themselves.
Have you had experience in your own... Well, let me start with a broader question. Do you bring your own life experiences into your books, into your stories?
Only in the most benign background sort of ways. I have not had the sort of experiences that I write about, thankfully. I was an assistant DA, and so I draw generally on my background in that. Being in courthouses gives you a kind of fluency in the language of the law that gives my books an authenticity that I think would be hard to replicate just with research. But I do draw on my personal life quite a bit. And this has been a purposeful decision. My first couple of books were more traditional crime novels in the sense that they involved street crime. And it seemed to me that there was a fantasy element that readers brought to crime novels in that most crime novel readers are not criminals. Most crime novel readers would not so much as steal a candy bar from CVS. And yet they will happily read about murderers and thugs and thieves and find something in it for them. And yet the supposition is that crime is always happening somewhere else.
Somewhere
unlike me in a neighborhood unlike mine. And so I wanted to close that gap. I wanted readers to feel this could happen to anyone. This could happen to you. And the way I made that feel authentic to myself is to constantly bring the story closer and closer to my experience of the world. So in Defending Jacob and in this new book, you have a family that parallels my own in significant ways. I live in Newton, and I tend to situate my books there. And I find that doing so helps me to bring that sense of authenticity to the writing. I can write from the heart because I'm writing things that genuinely are close to my heart.
We're talking to local best-selling author Bill Lande. The newest book is All That Is Mine, I Carry With Me. It came out on March 7th. You talk about increasingly bringing things closer to your own life and your own experience. You know, I've learned in book festivals and all the book talks that I do out in public events and spaces that people are always interested in the process, right? How did you... And so I have a couple of research questions on this book because this book... And there might, I'm not going to guarantee there won't be spoil alerts, so let me just tell listeners that now. I'll try not to, but that one does slip sometimes on live radio. This book is told from a number of different voices, but that missingness, this woman who is gone and no one knows what happened, haunts all the voices. And I wonder, did you talk to a lot of people who had experienced missing persons in their lives? Did you do a lot of research in that space? Because there is a pall, not in a bad, well, I mean, that, yes, that is bad, but a haunting over every page with her being missing.
There is a pall that's cast by this woman's absence. I did not research it. I think that these things can be freely imagined. And to the extent the situation is interesting to me, it's interesting because it parallels universal experiences that we all can relate to. We've all lost somebody who was important to us in one way or another. And we've all also grown up to move away from our parents, to become independent, and to lose them in that smaller sense, and also to meet our parents as fellow adults and to see their flaws and to get to know them as more rounded human beings than we may have imagined they were when we were children. And so those sorts of experiences of looking at our parents and wondering what sort of people they actually are is inherent in this book. It's the real subject. You know, defending Jacob plugged into the anxiety of parents looking down the family tree, as it were, at their children. In a way, this is the mirror image of that. This is children looking up the family tree at their parents and wondering what's really going on there.
So let's stay with that. There are a couple other things I know I want to get to, but that's a perfect opportunity to play you a little sound. This is from the series Defending Jacob. This is Chris Evans speaking with his wife and son.
My father, your grandfather, he's in prison. He's been there for a very long time. Last time I saw him, I was 6 years old. My mother took me to see him in prison right after his arrest.
You said he left when you were just a baby.
That's what I told everybody growing up. It's the same lie my mother told people.
Wait, you said you never knew your father.
I know.
So for those of you who have not read Defending Jacob, just a little bit of what happens in that book. But what strikes me about it is this isn't just family. This is parents and kids. And it's also bad dads. And I was interested to talk to you about that as well. The bad dad and this complexity of when we stop trusting the people we're supposed to trust most in the world, parents to kids until they're teenagers, right? But kids to parents, too. Those are the people you're supposed to be able to rely on.
You're supposed to be able to rely on each other, parents and children, and yet that's always a fraught relationship. Mothers and daughters, fathers and sons. These are difficult relationships. They're relationships that we do not choose, and they're relationships that we really can't walk away from. So we have to find a way to make it work. And these people are a presence in our lives that we study, and we simply have to take their history along with them. And that is something that all people can relate to. And that's why I do think of these books as family stories, much more so than crime stories.
So in this book, we've got the dad under suspicion, we've got the mom who has disappeared, we've got the adult son and the adult daughter who are living the continued aftermath of what has happened, and the friend who's writing the book. So a couple of things that struck me there. First, this mom reminds me of real women who have disappeared here. So, you know, one of our producers said it reminds them of Anna Walsh in Cohasset, the woman who disappeared on New Year's Day and whose husband has been charged in murdering her. It made me think of the Lady of the Dunes. It made me think of the young women killed by the Truro killer. It made me think of the Boston Strangler victims. So, you know, you are local. You live in Newton. Are you bringing forward, do you think you were influenced by, you wrote a book on the Boston Strangler. Do you think you were influenced by the real crimes of missing women, especially white suburban women or white wives and young women that we have a history of with killings here?
There is a very long history, both here and nationally. This is something that happens. And one of the things that makes those cases so haunting is the doubt. And this is a book that's about doubt. It's about not knowing. It's a woman goes missing, and the book addresses the weight of her absence over a very long period on her children. How do we come to terms with not knowing? We like to think when we look at criminal cases that we can come to 100% certainty about what happened. But anybody who investigates crimes, anybody who tries cases in court, knows that there is some measure of doubt, and you never reach 100% certainty. A guilty verdict does not mean you're 100% certain. And in fact, DNA evidence has now exposed that there's a much higher error rate than we might have liked to think, because it makes us confront the righteousness of what we're doing with our courts and with our police. So living with that doubt is a fact of life, both in criminal law and in our lives. We have to live with not knowing quite a bit about these people and where they've been and what they're capable of.
So I can't resist asking you. So on Friday, we're going to speak with director and writer Matt Ruskin and actor Chris Cooper about the new Hulu film on the Boston Strangler. And, you know, that story, and I don't think I'm giving anything away saying this, keeps that doubt question. It is a disturbing thought that we could go. I mean, your these last two books have a real criminal justice system process in them, right? And you go for the unsatisfying, disturbing answer. Do you have faith in our criminal justice system?
I certainly have faith in our criminal justice system. I think it's the best that we can do, given that we are human beings who are prone to error. However, I think it's important to remember that this feeling of doubt and uncertainty isn't limited to that. This is a feeling that permeates all aspects of our lives now because we live in an information environment that's so corrupted and so distracting that we've come to a point where we feel like we just don't know what we can rely on as fact. And so this feeling of uncertainty, of not knowing what's the truth, is something that we take with us throughout the day. When we read the news, we bring a certain cynicism to it. We feel as though we can't know the truth. And we simply have to learn to abide a certain level of not knowing. And that is part of the human condition. And it's a feeling that is very much of this cultural moment as well.
Did you learn anything about yourself or about people that you didn't know before in writing All That Is Mine I Carry With Me?
I learn about myself and about people with every book that I write. One thing that's interesting about book writing is it casts you back on yourself. It's a very solitary profession. It's very difficult. You look inward for a year or two or three, in this case, 10. This was a very long struggle to write this book. And so you do learn about yourself. Most people don't look inward with that sort of concentration for that long a time. And you do tend to come out of it with new insights.
We've got 15, 20 seconds left. You make reference to the 10 years, right? And the book starts with somebody talking about writer's block. Are you relieved, excited? Now that it's done, how do you feel?
Certainly relieved. I'm relieved with every book. I find that writing is such a struggle. It's such laborious uphill work, and it doesn't get easier as you move from book to book. Your standards only get higher as your skills increase. So every book comes as a relief.
So Bill Landay is best-selling author, resident in Newton. The latest book, All That Is Mine I Carry With Me, came out on March 7th. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Amanda Beeland and Rob Lane, with Bart Tacci and John Bender. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer, with help today from Jeff Cohen. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.